And most of the Bodhicharya Avatar is, in fact, a detailed discussion of the path of transformation, looking in particular at the practice of what are called the six paramitas, or the six perfections. These are the practices, the kind of core bodhisattva practices: generosity, ethics, patience and forbearance, vigour, meditation and wisdom. We're not going to go into these this morning, it would take much too long to explore them, but you know, it's well worth looking up Sangharakshita's book on the bodhisattva ideal, transcriptions of his lectures. It really explores these perfections in great depth and detail. I just want to stay with the theme of transformation, and I want to look in particular at the transformation of an extraordinarily important aspect of our lives. Yesterday we looked at, you know, death and the whole issue of meaning. Well, there are other kind of essential areas, and, well, I want to look at that very important area of our life, love and desire. So a huge area, this, a huge topic, love and desire, a real, you know, big one for us. So it's so important to us. I don't know about you, but I know that for me, to love and to be loved is central to my being. To love and to be loved are as central as concerns about death and life. Probably there's a whole discussion to go on to do with loving and being loved and life and death and so on. Shantideva has a lot to say about this subject, particularly in the section, interestingly enough, on meditation, Dhyana Paramita, the perfection of meditation. And here, in this section, the teachings here are in fact regarded as his unique contribution to Buddhist practice. He's basing himself on, you know, obviously the Buddha's teachings, but he's kind of pushed them and taken them in a very interesting direction. But first, a few general comments. Love is one of the words in English which covers so many meanings. And it's also, because of that, a word that causes immense confusion. Someone might say to us, or we might say to them, "I love you." And we can mean all kinds of things by "I love you." We might mean, "I'm attracted to you," "I fancy you," "I want you," "I need you." We might mean by it, although we won't necessarily admit it, "I love you at this moment in time, and these feelings might well change." When somebody more attractive comes along, or I get bored. But the other person might have interpreted "I love you" to mean, "I will always love you, selflessly, through thick and thin." And of course, the result is often utter confusion, pain, hurt, disappointment, and all the rest of it. I'm simplifying, I know. I'm caricaturing, I know. But I just want to sort of, you know, expose the confusions that can be in this very simple and oft used and abused phrase, "I love you." You know, confusion does happen around this. Buddhism has striven down the ages to bring precision, you know, to the language of love. It's good having the precision. It doesn't mean to say that we apply that precision. But let's have a look at some of the words that might be contained in the simple phrase, "I love you." Well, there's raga, which means something like intense sexual passion. Kama, sensual desire. It's not the same as karma, karma, K-A-M-A. Prema, which sometimes has been translated as quasi-sexual attached affection. Then there's sneha, although I must admit I prefer the Pali term sineha, which is best translated as sticky affection, clingy affection, sineha. And these are regarded, the ones I've just mentioned, as not particularly helpful emotions, but of course they are all mixed up in our understanding of love. And then of course there's Maitri, metta, friendly love, all-inclusive loving-kindness, boundless loving-kindness, where you love people for what they are, as they are in themselves. There's no sexual interest, there's no self-interest at all in this loving-kindness. It's friendly love taken to its height. We could go on, it's a very interesting topic, trying to sort of distinguish these different emotions. But I think what I'm trying to get at here, this sort of discussion at least opens up the possibility of some thought about the nature of love and friendliness and attraction and desire and affection and so on. They're often very mixed up for us. And because they're all kind of mixed up, they can confuse our relationships with people. And it's good to bring to some clarity to bear on this sort of subject. For Shantideva, actually, the issue is very clear, at least as in terms of practice. Shantideva was a celibate monk, certainly in the early days, and certainly when he was at Nalanda. He followed what's called brahmacharya, which is celibacy, chastity. He'd renounced all sexual activity. He'd renounced all sexual relationships. He'd renounced the notion of getting married, having a family, and so on. And in his section on meditation, he speaks, first of all, of the importance of going away to the jungle to meditate in solitude, away from the crowd, away from arguments and business and hustle and bustle. He talks about the importance of going away into retreat to give himself fully to the bodhicitta without any distraction. It is important to get away sometimes on retreat to find supportive conditions for our practice. A weekend like this, obviously we're not alone, but I hope the conditions are supportive to you for your practice, for your meditation practice and your practice more broadly. We need supportive conditions. After that, Shantideva has a long passage of various incredibly vivid reflections which are to counter sexual craving for a woman. It's a very interesting passage indeed, because although he's celibate, from the way the text is written, I mean, maybe it's just a skillful means he's writing it for other people, but the way the text is written, it is obviously dealing with sexual craving. And it is amazing what can arise when you go off and meditate intensively, or just if you do a bit more meditation than usual. Maybe you've had some really good experience in your meditation. You know, you've taken up meditation and, you know, you meditate day to day and it calms your mind and you get nice warm feelings going. It all goes well. But then maybe if you go and do a retreat, you can be well overwhelmed by the strangest of things, the strangest of desires. I'll never forget the first solitary retreat I went on. I hadn't been meditating for very long and I was getting into my meditation. And then suddenly, out of the clear blue sky, there appeared an enormous Mars bar. And I hadn't actually thought or even eaten a Mars bar. I couldn't remember the last time I'd eaten a Mars bar. And it became an utter obsession. And in my meditation, I spent the whole time planning when I do the walk, which was quite a long walk, into the village to track down the shop to buy the coveted Mars bar, which would be such an overwhelmingly wonderful experience. And, you know, and I thought, well, no, you're here on retreat. No, don't do... Eventually I did, and of course, the trek was really exciting, but the Mars bar was a massive disappointment. So don't be surprised if you're overwhelmed by all sorts of strange desires when you meditate more intensively. It doesn't mean that you're a sort of, you know, a uniquely flawed being and a terrible failure at spiritual life, you know, and a terrible sinner because you have these Mars bar or magnum cravings, or, you know, maybe for some, you know, for strange sexual desires coming up. These things are already there. You're just beginning to see them and experience them more directly, more vividly, more clearly. And when they come up, that means that there's more of a possibility of spiritual transformation. You can transform all that.